If you are known to enthuse about great photography, I can't recommend anything much higher than a new collection of night photography, night photos, photos of the night sky with landscape below. You'll find these at a website, twanight.org. That stands for the World at Night. .org, and what these are winners and honorable mention photos from the 7th International Earth and Sky Photo Contest. I started my day with these, and it was a really pleasant and invigorating start to the day. Photography and images that you just won't. These are just so out of the ordinary, it's extraordinary. Plus, it is time-lapse videos as well, not just still photography, but time-lapse videos as well. Of the night sky and the landscape below, twanight.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR, the MSU community's mourning the loss of one of its greatest sports figures. Ron Mason was a renowned Spartan hockey coach who ended his 23-year run at Michigan State with the most wins of any collegiate hockey coach in history. That number is 924. Mason led MSU to a national hockey championship in 1986 and many playoff titles. Afterwards, Ron Mason served 5 years as MSU's athletics director. Ron passed away yesterday at the age of 76. News of his death came as a shock to many Spartans, including his protege, current MSU hockey coach Tom Anastas.
I've known him since I was 17 years old, and he recruited me to come here, and he's had such an impact on me and my professional life. It's mind-blowing to me when I heard the news early this morning of our loss.
We've invited two people who knew Ron Mason well to share their memories of this extraordinary man. Tom Newton is the assistant head coach of the MSU Spartan hockey team. Tom, welcome.
Thanks, Mark.
And Scott Moore is the play-by-play announcer, the voice of Spartan hockey. He's with the Spartan Sports Network. Scott Moore, good to see you again.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Our condolences to both of you guys. Both of you knew Ron Mason. I knew him casually, nowhere near as well as you two did. Tom, how and when did you first meet Ron?
I first met Ron when I was very young. I was 13 or 14 years old and attended a hockey camp that he ran in Centralia, Ontario. So I've known him for a long time, and we sort of started a relationship at that young age. I think he might have thought I could skate and shoot a little bit, so he sort of kept me in mind.
And you can say you knew him from the age of 13? Really?
Yeah, I did.
How about that?
Yeah, so and then it just continued to grow from there.
What did he mean to you as a friend, as a mentor?
He loved life. As a friend, he was somebody you could go and talk to and have a few laughs and always wanted to talk hockey and talk sports. So he was somebody he could always communicate with and talk to about things. As on a professional level, he was
available. Accessible guy. I always got that impression.
He was just a very personable guy that he could talk about anything. That's just the way he operated, and he was very comfortable with it.
Scott, you've been Spartan hockey announcer since 1997. You're closing in on 20 years, my friend.
20 years this year.
How about that? How about you? Your first recollection, your first meeting or acquaintance with Ron Mason, and how did it unfold?
Well, I was lucky enough to cover the team for a local radio station for a couple of years and then hooked on with the East Lansing Cable Group. with their live coverage of the Spartan hockey games back in the 80s. And so I gradually got to know him a little bit through that. But really, the thing that I think about is the chance that he took on me, because when the decision was made to put me into the play-by-play position, he had to check off on that. They asked him, is it okay if this guy does this? And he took a chance on me and really proceeded from that point on to teach me the game of hockey, because I was a relative outsider. I didn't play the game growing up. I really knew nothing about it, even when I showed up on campus in 1978.
So you had broadcasting chops, but you didn't necessarily have hockey chops.
I thought I knew what I was doing broadcasting-wise, but there are still people who will tell me I don't know anything about the game of hockey, too. So, but you're just getting to talk with him on our pregame chats every single game and learning about it. And I remember one time I asked some question during a pregame chat in our first year. And when we finished up the chat, I turned the recorder off and he looked at me, he says, "That was a good question. You're starting to get this now."
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, that was, I took that as a real pat on the back from him.
Validation. Ron Mason was in leadership roles here. That's how people in East Lansing remember him, the head hockey coach, and then going on to athletic director. Tom, how would you describe Ron Mason's leadership style?
Well, I think Ron was a person that didn't make decisions without great thought. And he would reflect on all the different areas that were going to be affected with decisions. And he'd contemplate those, and he was not afraid. He was not afraid to make tough decisions. And I think he'd say that a lot of them he felt were good decisions. Others, like anybody that is making decisions, you maybe want a do-over. But I think his batting average was very, very high. And as a leader, he wasn't a guy that was afraid to step up and be counted on when it wasn't 75 and sunny. He was when things were cold or and hot and sticky and freezing, hey, he'd come to the front. So he cherished the role of the leader.
We'll also point out to our listeners who may not be aware of this, I imagine a lot of our listeners know you as an assistant hockey coach at MSU, but we'll point out Tom was a four-year letter winner and two-year captain for the Bowling Green State University Falcons, right. 1975 to 1980. Tom skated for three CCHA regular season and two playoff championship teams for then Bowling Green State coach Ron Mason. How did he motivate hockey players, Tom?
He kept the game very simple. He was a great evaluator of talent. So he put you into situations that you could apply yourself and be successful. He motivated players by creating an atmosphere that wanted you to do your best. That was with quality practices, with a good communication as to what was expected of you. And I think that because he evaluated players and people well, he got the right people into his program and got great results because of his style.
We're talking about the passing of Ron Mason, the Michigan State University hockey coach and athletic director who died yesterday at the age of 76. My guests are Tom Newton, assistant head coach of the Spartan hockey team, and Scott Moore, the hockey announcer for the Spartan Sports Network. We've got some tape we want to play right now. Scott, you and your colleagues at Spartan Sports made this possible. We appreciate that. I'll set the scene here. A lot of our listeners remember the Cold War, the 2001 outdoor hockey match between MSU and the University of Michigan at Spartan Stadium. Record crowd, some 74,000 people. Scott, here's part of an interview you did with Ron Mason years afterward, recounting the match. You're talking here about Jim Slater, the Spartan whose goal tied the game at three. Let's listen.
Oh, Jim Slater, just a wonderful goal there. 47 seconds left in the game. A freshman playing in his first ever college game in front of that kind of a crowd, and the crowd just exploded.
Yes, and, you know, we went into overtime, and we had a setup play for Adam Hall off the faceoff, and we won it perfectly. And 9 times out of 10, he would have scored, but he just missed the net on the one-timer. And I think if we would have scored that goal, Spartan Stadium might have fallen down. You know?
It might have. I think you're right. Loose in the slot. Goldie had it on his stick for a moment. Comes to the side. It's a goal for Michigan State. The Spartans have tied it up with 47 seconds left in the game. And this time it's a center as well. Jim Slater gets the goal that ties the game at 3-all.
Scott Moore, your recollection of the Cold War.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, what a night. And just when you think back on it and you think about everything that had happened the week before with the sun coming out and the warm temperatures and not being able to maintain the ice, and then it gets cold that day and the ice was great and the atmosphere, the sold-out stadium and everything, it was just, it's one of the top memories of my career. You know, and it had never been done before. And look what has happened since, because you know, Ron Mason and Tom and Dave McAuliffe and Mark Hollis and everybody, you know, took the chance and said, let's go ahead and try it, and started a fad.
Ron was into the idea?
Yeah. I was at a meeting where Director Hollis, an associate director, put a presentation together saying how they'd put the ice surface in. And he was looking for a thumbs up from Ron before I think he went to President Simon, and it went from there. So it was he was on board. I remember him telling Mark, he says, this will either help your career or kill your career if this one happens.
It'll make it or kill it. Ron Mason was inducted into the USA Hockey Hall of Fame in 2013. We've got another clip now. This is just part of his acceptance speech where he imparts some life lessons.
You know, I've always loved the game. The game has been my life. And I learned very quickly that if you're going to be successful, there's a few things you have to have. One is, you have to have an unbelievable work ethic. You have to have equal or better than equal talent than the guy you're playing against. You can't beat the game itself. It will chew you up if you think you're going to reinvent things in the game. And then what you have to do is you have to have a character to work through the bad times and make them better.
Pretty solid advice there.
Oh.
What are you going to remember from Ron Mason, Tom?
Just that you have to have passion for what you do, and if you're not all the way in, you're in the way. And if you were going to work with him, you were all the way in.
Was that one of his sayings?
No,
if you're not, oh, okay.
No,
okay.
That wasn't his. But that's how we operated.
It's a good one.
I can tell you that. And if you were part of his program, you were all the way in and you were pedal to the floor. So that's the way he operated.
Your most durable impression of Ron Mason that you'll carry with you, Scott?
It's the fact that he could focus at the right times. I mean, you know, I've often joked there were three Ron Masons. There was regular, you know, middle of the week Ron. There was game day Ron, who was incredibly intense. And then there was Michigan game day Ron, who was even more intense. And you could always tell when I went in for a pregame interview who we were playing, because it was either intense or super intense. But as soon as the game was over, and if we won, certainly it went quicker than if we lost, and we didn't lose very many when Ron was coaching. But you know, he had the ability to cast all of that aside and get back to life.
Can either of you share anything about final arrangements, visitation, what have you?
There will be a visitation at Munn Ice Arena on Thursday from 11 to 2. and a service following at Mullen Arena at 2 o'clock.
Okay. We have been paying tribute to the late Ron Mason here, the legendary MSU hockey coach who led the Spartans from 1979 to 2002. His tenure included a national collegiate championship in 1986. Ron Mason died yesterday at the age of 76. Tom Newton is the assistant head coach of the Spartan hockey team. Scott Moore is the play-by-play hockey announcer for the Spartan Sports Next Network. Tom, Scott, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
MSU, we love thy shadows when twilight's silence falls, flushing deep and softly paling o'er ivy covered halls.
And coming up on Current State, Michigan's moose population is on the decline. That's prompting the federal government to consider extending the animal additional protections under the Endangered Species Act. We'll talk with Drew Youngdyke of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs and Dan Kennedy, the Endangered Species Coordinator for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, coming up. Well, summertime brings peak activity in the home buying, selling, and building season. Current State takes you now to a unique 20th century house. Usonian is an architectural term attributed to Frank Lloyd Wright, describing some of his affordable family home designs beginning in the 1930s. Usonian homes were typically small, single-story dwellings without a garage or much storage, as thoughtfully designed as Wright's commissions for far wealthier clients. A group of young professionals in Kalamazoo County were among the first to embrace Wright's innovative idea. Sharon Ferraro is co-author of the Michigan History Magazine article, Kalamazoo County's Usonian Communities. WKAR's Peter Wharf speaks with Ferraro about the neighborhoods and about Wright.
The idea of the Usonian home was to have something that was reasonably priced, that was not the high-end expensive houses that Wright designed for some of his large people. They were designed to be in the 40s and 50s when they were being built. They were designed to be built for somewhere around $10,000, which was a middle class, reasonable cost for a home. Wright usually didn't do a very good job of reining in costs, but nonetheless, the idea was that it would be simple homes that everybody could live in, middle class homes, and that they wouldn't be just scaled down versions of the larger, fancier homes. So it wasn't going to be a pseudo-colonial or any other type of standing architectural style. It was going to be something new in and of itself that really made it easy for the family to live in. And there's some debate about what Usonian actually means, and no one has really come to a definite definition of what he meant by that. He never actually wrote it down.
Right.
So, yeah, but supposedly it was his acronym for the United States of North America.
Right.
The USON, but we don't have that for sure.
But we can come to a better understanding of what we're about to talk about, probably if you describe some of the features of these homes for sort of the average person that are also found in some of the famous places, these famous sort of Wright characteristics mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. The home mm-hmm. architecture. Can you talk about mm-hmm. some of those?
Absolutely. One of the driving characteristics of Frank Lloyd Wright was that the house needed to fit into the environment. It needed to move in harmony with the environment around it. For example, on many of his homes, whether they're the Usonians or whether they're the very high-end homes, they tend to have very deep eaves, and is because he was building mostly in the north, because that way you get the shade that you need in the summer to keep the house from heating up too much. But in the winter, when the sun is lower in the sky, you get as much light as you can get into the house at that time period. So that was one of the features that he had both in his high-end homes and in his more modest homes. He tended to, like many of the craftsmen from previous years, he tended to approve more of materials that were found locally. And in the case of the Usonian homes, he literally, one of the things he provided along with the plans was a design for the casting of the blocks. And it was very common for the families that had the homes built to actually build them themselves. They would buy the concrete, and or they'd mix the concrete, and then they would cast the blocks themselves until they had enough to start building. So it was kind of a do-it-yourself kind of plan as well. His idea of not having a basement, did not like to have a basement. He felt it was just a damp place for things to get lost. So he did not like to have basements unless it was necessary. He didn't like porches, so those he didn't have. He didn't especially like garages. He was one of the first people to design a carport. In fact, you could probably even give him credit for designing the idea of a carport where a car would be parked under a roof outdoors, but it would not be an entire four-sided building. So he had some ideas that he built into his larger homes, but he also kind of scaled down to work into the Usonian houses. Built-in storage everywhere. Down the hallways, it's usually a row of closets down the hallways. That way you don't need an attic and you don't need a basement. Your storage is right there in those closets. The windows that would let light in, he kind of had an odd idea about how much room people needed. He actually, in one house, he designed the bedroom small enough that the only way that the couple could live in it was to have a twin bed for the two of them to share.
A 30-inch wide bed for two people.
Yes, right. For two people. Exactly, exactly. Like they was, supposedly they wanted to be mom and dad. They might not end up being mom and dad with the 30-inch wide bed.
Right.
But nonetheless, he had these ideas of how he wanted people to live. He would design the furniture. He wanted to design the entire environment for the family that owned the home. I think he was very much an artist in that sense, is that he wanted to control all the details of it, the furniture, the decorations to a certain degree, the materials on the walls, paint colors. All those things were things that were often specified in his plans. And even the furniture, though, was designed that the family could build it themselves. Probably they could either have someone else do it or they could do it themselves. So I mean, it wasn't complex furniture. It was just, but it was very simple. So he was a very interesting man. He was a very interesting man.
As an intellectual yourself, Mr. Wright, what do you think of President...
I deny the allegation, and I refuse to marry that girl.
What do you think of...
I don't like intellectuals.
You don't like intellectuals? Why not?
Because they're superficial. They're up top. They're from the top down, not from the ground up. I've always flattered myself that what I represented was from the ground up. Does that mean anything?
I'm trying to figure it out.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Sharon Ferraro about her article, Kalamazoo County's Usonian Communities, from a recent Michigan History magazine publication, co-authored with Pamela O'Connor. Sharon, tell me about the Kalamazoo Cooperative that you refer to in the article and the Upjohn component, you know, those two things that sort of go together in Western Michigan.
It's just after the Second World War, there were a bunch of new scientists that had been hired by Upjohn. Upjohn was growing as a pharmaceutical company by leaps and bounds at that point. And so these were first jobs for a lot of these newly minted scientists that were going to be doing research and working at the Upjohn company. And they kind of got to know each other and got together, and they thought, we want to have a nice place to live. And they thought it would be nice to have kind of a co-op where they would buy the land in common, and then everybody would have a lot, and they would build houses. And they started out looking for an architect. They looked at several different architects, but Wright was the one that they felt really had their vision the most clearly in mind, what they wanted to do, both something where they could get their own sweat equity as part of it. You know, they could do some of the work themselves, or that he understood the idea of them living close to each other, but also having community facilities. Like, originally the idea was to have a pool, definitely green space, a little clubhouse, that kind of thing would go with the communities. And once they got to the point where they hired Wright and they wanted him to actually design the houses, and he designed, the houses are all different. They weren't cookie cutter houses. Each one was designed for its specific environment. They realized that there was actually kind of a rift between in the organization, very, very amiable, but nonetheless a rift, that some people wanted to live further out in the country and some people wanted to live closer to the city. And so they parted ways, but they kept Wright as their architect for both groups. And one group built their houses near the town of Galesburg, a little bit south of Galesburg in Charleston Township, and that's called the Acres, and it's still there with its four Wright houses and one Wright student-designed house. And then the other group built, at that point, what was the very edge of the city of Kalamazoo, and now it's been incorporated into the city in an area that's called Parkwind Village. And so all the lots were designed, all the houses were designed specifically for the lots that they were going on. That for a while they tried to recruit more people because each subdivision had approximately 20 lots in it. a little more or less, and they had only filled four or five in each subdivision.
Sharon, I was also fascinated to read from an advertisement attempting to recruit additional members for the Parkwind Village Association and the Acres, and I just wanted to read that right now.
Sure.
The ad read, "The Parkwind Village Association and the Acres are the realization of one common dream, the opportunity to work out by an individual family its aims and ideals in a new home, one that is well-designed, comfortable, and homey, and not necessarily expensive, located in an area that is spacious for maximum privacy, yet among congenial neighbors with similar ideals who join together when the need arises to work out economically plans and developments to get the most in better living at minimum cost to all." That's a heck of a sentence right there.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the movement we have going with the new urbanism now, where it reminds me a lot of some of the statements I've seen about those developments. So
yeah, it's really more of a manifesto than an advertisement, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was not really effective at getting people in, but it's a wonderful artifact of how they were, what the cooperative members were trying to achieve.
Kalamazoo County's Usonian Communities is a recent article in Michigan History Magazine by Sharon Ferraro and Pamela O'Connor. Been speaking to Sharon Ferraro. Thanks a lot for this tour through Frank Lloyd Wright in Western Michigan.
You're very welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And coming up on Current State, we'll stroll down the Lansing Street where newspaper kiosks have been turned into an art exhibition. Learn more about the Lansing Art Gallery's pop-up art special edition installation, that and lots more after the break on Current State. And we'll point out that with a monthly donation of $10 or more, you will receive a WKAR reusable travel mug as our thanks to you. You can donate at WKAR.org. Click on the Give Now link. This is Current State on WKAR. Federal wildlife officials are planning to review the status of moose in Michigan and in three other Midwest states. This comes after the feds received what they say is substantial information in a petition from two environmental groups. The review could eventually lead to protections for moose, including threatened or endangered species status. State wildlife officials say there are around 500 moose in Michigan, all in the Upper Peninsula. To learn more here on our weekly environmental segment, Current State welcomes two guests. Dan Kennedy is the Endangered Species Coordinator in the Wildlife Division for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Mark.
And Drew Youngdyke is a spokesman for the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, which represents more than 40,000 hunters, anglers, trappers, and conservationists in the state. Hi, Drew.
Hi there.
Dan Kennedy, before we get into this process, this species assessment, it's called, in Michigan, we'll point out the other three states here, too, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota. As a specialist here in endangered or threatened species, what was your initial response when you heard this?
When I first heard about the petition to list the moose, I was pretty amazed. I didn't think that, I didn't know that there were several different subspecies or potential subspecies of moose across North America. And so I was taken aback by the petition.
Mm. We will get into a little bit more detail as to the importance of what this subspecies is and try to clear that up. Help us understand what role the agency, the DNR, will play in this assessment.
Great question. So the Michigan DNR will, the listing determination is up to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a federal, so it's been petitioned as a federally listed species. And the Fish and Wildlife Service wants to cooperate and collaborate with the states on getting the best available science. And the Michigan DNR looks forward to working with the service on gathering that information.
Drew Youngdyke, the MUCC, is largely an advocate for hunters and anglers, but moose cannot be hunted in Michigan or in Minnesota, as I understand. What is the MUCC's interest in this?
Well, sure. Well, you know, we're a conservation group first and foremost, and, you know, hunters care about conservation first and foremost as well. So with moose, they're actually listed as a game species, but we don't have an actual hunting season for them because in order to hunt them a few years ago when they formed a panel to look at this, they wanted to make sure that their growth rate was strong, you know, that they were growing at a certain percentage yearly. Until we saw that, we didn't want to have a hunting season for them. So they're listed as a game species, but with no hunting season because their population wasn't where we wanted it to be.
What's the most desirable outcome for your organization here then? Would it be to increase the numbers of moose in Michigan to the point where hunting the animals could be justified?
Well, I think when you look at having a hunt for a species, what that says is that's a strong population of a species.
Sure.
You know, if we can responsibly have a hunt for them, then that's a strong species that's doing well. That's good for conservation.
Let's clarify how many moose there are here in Michigan. Dan, I know a 2015 survey indicated a decline of over 100 moose in the western UP from 2013. So for 2015, decline of 100 compared to 2013. The estimate was 451 in 2013 and 323 in 2015. Is that number lower still in 2016, or do we know? Is it lower, higher, about the same? What?
So we will be doing our surveys again this winter. So we didn't do them this past winter. So we will be doing surveys again and be able to get a gauge on where we're at this coming winter, in the winter of 2016 and 17. But the decline was actually not statistically different. So we believe there's a decline, but the statistics tell us that it's not statistically significant. And what we have is we have approximately 100 moose in the east end of the UP, approximately 325 in the west end of the UP, and about 1,300 on Isle Royale.
That is a lot of moose on Isle Royale. I know the population has gone up on Isle Royale. What's behind that?
Well, there's several things, but what the researchers believe is the primary cause is the reduction in the wolf population.
So the natural predator of the moose, that population has gone down.
Correct.
Describe, what do we know about the kind of information that the Fish and Wildlife Service received from these two groups? And I'll identify them. They are called the Center for Biological Diversity and a group called Honor the Earth. What kind of information did they present to Fish and Wildlife that it found compelling enough to launch this status review? Do you know?
So the service is a pretty low bar to meet the first step in the federal listing process. They can only review the information within the proposal and within their own files, and they determined that that information was considered substantial and that it warranted additional investigation. And the primary issues that they covered was they went through the description of what the subspecies is, and then they also focused a lot on climate change and how a change in climate might affect moose in the United States.
Drew, I know MUCC has a couple of concerns involving the petition from these groups that involves these subspecies. Can you walk us through what those are?
Well, so the moose population in Michigan had an influx in the 80s, and Dan can probably talk about this a little bit too. But in 1985, we had a moose lift in that winter of 84-85. And the moose that were transplanted, it was a DNR effort. It was jointly funded by SCI, and we helped fund it a little bit too. But the moose came from all
SCI as well.
Oh, sorry, Safari Club International.
Okay.
And the moose were brought in from Algonquin Provincial Park, which is in Ontario. When you look at that subspecies breakdown, Algonquin Provincial Park is in the eastern moose subspecies range, whereas this petition is for the northwestern subspecies of moose. So I think it's at least questionable that the moose that we have in the UP are the eastern subspecies, or probably at least a mix if there are some northwestern subspecies.
And it appears there's been a pretty dramatic decline in Minnesota. I want to say that I believe I've read that one, if not both of these groups, are particularly concerned about that subspecies that is in Minnesota. Do I have that right, Drew?
Right. The Minnesota...
Dan, I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
Sure, sure. I've talked to my counterparts in Minnesota, and they are worried about it. They've had a 60% decline in the moose population in their state, and they are concerned about that.
Now, you described yourself as being taken aback by this. Can we interpret that to mean you don't think a species assessment is justified here?
No, it's just that there are 26 other federally listed species in Michigan that I spend my time on, and I just probably was, I was just not up to speed on the moose, what was happening to moose in North America. That's
okay.
All.
Okay. Drew, you are you saying that you don't think a species assessment is justified?
Well, whether or not they're doing the assessment, what's probably wouldn't be justified if they determine that we have the eastern subspecies of moose is they're looking at this as a distinct population segment for listing. It's likely then that the Michigan population of moose that's on the mainland of the Upper Peninsula isn't part of that same subspecies that,
gotcha.
That they've
okay.
requested. So at the very least, Michigan probably shouldn't be included in this listing if they move forward with it. And that's something just based on the moose we have here, where they came from in the 80s. But I think that's something that probably warrants a little more investigation.
We're talking about a planned federally led review of the status of moose in Michigan and three other states. We're talking with Dan Kennedy of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. You just heard Drew Youngdyke of the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Dan, what do you feel is the optimal number? I mean, does DNR have an optimal number, the ideal number of moose that should be living in the state of Michigan?
I believe that there was a plan written a couple years ago where we identified a goal of 1,000 moose in the Upper Peninsula, on the mainland of the Upper Peninsula.
And we're at about 400 some now, is that it?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Probably, you know, 400, 450. And the issue is that we have some error associated with our surveys because there's when we do our surveys, they're adjusted primarily for two main factors. It's called the sightability adjustment. It's whether or not you could see a moose. So it might be in some dense conifers and we can't see it. But we've done studies with radio telemetry to know and adjust when we do our surveys. We need to increase them by X percent because we can't see all the moose. And then the second part is that some moose, you know, you can't see them at some times of also during the day and also at night. So it's difficult to get. And the other part is that it depends if they're individual moose or in large groups of moose. Those two factors, the sightability and if they're in groups. And then so when we do our surveys, we adjust the numbers. So when we say 450, it's 450 plus or minus, you know, 100 or so.
Margin of error.
Correct. Correct.
What kind of role does MUCC envision here? Do you plan to play some kind of role in this species assessment, Drew?
Yeah, yes. Our group will be presenting comments on this during the public comment period. We also work with our national partners at the National Wildlife Federation. So we'll be coordinating with them and we'll be working with the DNR. You know, the DNR has excellent state level biologists. It's part of the reason that we think it's appropriate that the DNR's professional state level biologists are the ones who manage this moose population.
Well, we want to thank both of our guests. Drew Youngdyke is with the Michigan United Conservation Clubs. Dan Kennedy is with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking about a planned federally led review of the status of moose here in Michigan and in three other states. We'll try to stay in touch here. This is a kind of a long, drawn-out process. We'll try to stay in touch if we can as the process moves forward. We thank both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Mark.
This segment is supported by the Michigan State University Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for listening today. The Lansing Art Gallery has been located downtown for decades. However, this summer, the art will be spilling out onto the streets along Washington Square. This installation is part of the Lansing Art Gallery's project called Pop-Up Art Special Edition. Current State's Jamie Paisley went downtown to learn more about a very newsworthy method being used to showcase 12 Michigan artists currently on display. He spoke with Barb Whitney, executive director for the Lansing Art Gallery, who loves the responsibility that comes to promoting Michigan-based artists.
I like it. It's a responsibility I've grown into over the past year and a half as the director, but I really do enjoy representing Michigan artists, and there's so much to share. It's incredibly exciting for me.
Let's start with what is the underlying purpose of pop-up art? Because it's a public art space that you want to engage people with pop-up art.
Yes, pop-up art special edition is the second rendition of our pop-up art projects. And it's about bringing the arts outside of the gallery walls into the community with a focus on making the arts accessible, in this case, on the streets. So we used the newspaper kiosks as a forum for conversation and for artwork display, as well as a chance to really give people a better understanding of the extraordinary work that's being made in Michigan and how they can get involved.
And how did you find the 12 artists that are being represented here from various, you know, various media that they're using as well? How did you encounter them?
We do a statewide call for each of our exhibitions, and this one is no different. So we let everyone we know everywhere know about the opportunity to apply as artists. And then we host a jury panel that makes those selections. So in some cases, the panel itself attracts artists because they're artists themselves that are extraordinary in their own right. And we've learned that by having great adjudication, we sometimes engage more artists than we would have otherwise.
And you said statewide, because it is exclusive to Michigan artists as well.
That's right. Michigan exclusive is something that we do in all of our projects at Lansing Art Gallery. And in particular, in this case, we knew we had 12 kiosks and we were seeking 12 Michigan artists.
And the 12 kiosks there along Washington Square from, I think, Shiawassee down to Kalamazoo. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of over by the Lansing Center as well, right?
Yes, there are two over by the stadium. And we had a couple of funders that came from Team Lansing that were really excited about this project because those kiosks in particular caused them some problems in terms of feeling like an eyesore in the community. So they were especially keen on getting involved in helping us do all 12 kiosks so that they would have them presented beautifully, engaging people that were coming into the community, whether it's through the Lansing Center or through the Lugnut Stadium.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, as you were prepping for the kiosks, you then did repair to them as well, or polishing up is maybe a better word?
Polishing up is a great word. We covered up some things with something called Sintra, and our graphic designer and gallery coordinator extraordinaire, Sarah Pulver, put together the whole look of the kiosk to kind of brand them as a vehicle for Michigan artists with the pop-up logos and really giving people this glimpse into Michigan artists and how they can get involved. And so that is the design of the whole kiosk is Sarah Pulver's.
I'm Carolyn Damster. I'm an artist in the East Lansing area, and I do mostly landscape paintings. I do a lot of the Sleeping Bear Dunes area, but all of Michigan, and lately I'm kind of focusing more of home East Lansing and Michigan State campus.
You're originally from East Lansing?
I grew up in Grand Rapids, but I've been here since 85, so this is really my home.
You've settled at this point?
Yeah.
The roots are down, definitely. Right. And speaking of roots, could you describe what you've created for the Pop-Up Arts Special Edition?
Well, this is the Red Cedar River on the campus of Michigan State University, right on the main campus, and it kind of captures the reflection of the Red Cedar River and the path along the river, and I try to capture the feeling of the atmosphere and the wind in the trees and the feeling of being there. So it's not just a photograph, it captures the moment of being there.
Do you know where on the walk that your kiosk is displayed? Do you think of it as your kiosk at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. It's about one block or two blocks north of here on the east side of Washington.
Have you gone the walk yet?
I haven't done the whole walk. I parked by my kiosk today and took a selfie.
Naturally, naturally. Yeah. If people wanted to find more about your art, where could they head out?
Go visit www.carolindamstra.com.
Again, the Lansing Art Gallery's executive director, Barb Whitney. There's another component to Pop-Up Art Special Edition where you're having, for the next couple of months, on every Wednesday, I think it is, artists coming into the gallery as well.
Right. We did five Wednesdays, and they start actually this coming Wednesday with Tim coming for printmaking. And I understand each of the five has an interactive element. So it's not just a demonstration. It's an opportunity for all of us to get our hands dirty, I hope. Dirty, but to get our hand making art to some degree, or experiencing the process of making work like that artist makes.
Now, the curiosity begs me to ask: is there an age sort of appropriate level that you have for hands-on sort of elements? You don't know how permanent the dyes are, so to speak.
That's a great question. I know that we have told them we have age 7 to 12 year olds here for our summer art camp, which will be here during each of those 5 weeks. So we've asked that they be appropriate to some degree for that age demographic, but they should be available for all ages. And then I think parents, if they were with their children, could make the distinction of what they thought was appropriate in terms of, yes, that's a great question about dyes or printmaking materials. Generally, I think they'll be safe, free, and accessible.
And there's also the, if I understand correctly, as the artists are here, there's the opportunity to even purchase the what they're making, in if I'm reading that correctly.
Yes. We have, I think, 10 of the 12 originals here that are featured, which range quite significantly in size. So we saw them on a screen first, and then we saw them as reproductions that are 8x10, perfect to fit inside a frame. And then we saw the actual artwork coming in, and it ranges from about 8x10 inches to about 6x8 feet. And some of them are quite significant in scale. And so it's been really wonderful to see those, but all of those are also available for sale. So if you love the actual work of the reproduction of the work of art on the kiosk, and you needed to have it, we have them here.
Those will be sitting kind of in residency at the Lansing Art Gallery during the duration of Pop-Up Art Special Edition?
Yes, exactly. From June through August, those works will be here.
And you also are selling reproductions of those, I believe.
The reproductions are free. It's very exciting. Yeah, so if anybody wants to come down, if they have a favorite in the kiosks, they can come to the gallery and just simply ask for their favorite. We have them all on display behind the reception area at Lansing Art Gallery and Education Center. They can just let us know which one they'd like to take home.
Now, they can pick their favorite, and I won't ask you to pick your favorite because that's a hard thing to do, but do you have, say, top four?
Oh, wow. That is a challenge. There's one that is of interest in particular to me because it involves sewing. And when it came in, we weren't sure, based on the reproduction, what it was actually going to look like. And when it came in, we spent several minutes examining the work because it's very unusual and it involves the stitchery and the sewing, but it's translucent also. It's pretty incredible. It's a very small piece and of great interest to me.
We've been speaking with Lansing Art Gallery's executive director, Barb Whitney, about Pop-Up Art Special Edition, which can be seen in specially designed kiosks outside of Cooley Law Stadium and along Washington Square in downtown Lansing. Plus, you can stop by the gallery itself to view the original artworks now through August. More information about the 12 Michigan artists is available online at lansingartgallery.org/pop-up-art. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. We're glad you could join us. Tomorrow on Current State, the Lansing Area AIDS Network, or LAN, is dedicated to the delivery of services and programs that help meet the needs of those living with HIV/AIDS and to help prevent the further spread of the virus. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with LAN's prevention manager, Duane Riley, and with Alex Sands, a client and volunteer. It's Neighbors in Action every Wednesday here on Current State on WKAR. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks again to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill for engineering. Want to remind everyone that our next pop-up stories storytelling event, True First-Person Stories, will be happening Wednesday the 29th. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow. We hope you can join us either to tell a story about putting down roots. Putting down roots is the storytelling theme. Join us at the Allen Marketplace in Lansing, Wednesday the 29th from 6 till 7:30 p.m. If you'd like to learn more, go to our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. It's always a good time. True first-person stories last about 5 minutes. We had a great outing the last time around at the Robin Theater in Lansing, and we're looking forward to our event on Wednesday the 29th. We hope you can join us in one capacity or the other or both. Tell a story. Just join us to listen. There are snacks, and it's a good time. Allen Marketplace, Wednesday the 29th. Don't forget the Current State podcast as well. Your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, healthcare, tech, music, theater, stories from around the state and around Lansing in your hometown. The Current State podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get good podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you have a great day. You're listening to Current State on WKAR.